I've seen a lot of change, been through a lot of pain. Some things are not the same as they were a year ago, but all will be okay. I move on each and every day. The past is where it stays, way back a year ago.
Hey guys, welcome to the Wake and Make podcast, your favorite podcast centered around the maker community. Today's guest is one of my favorite human beings on planet Earth. I say that about all guests, but this is a very, very special opportunity. This week's guest is my very own grandpa, Les Simmons. Fun fact, I thought my grandpa was Kenny Rogers for the first 25 years of my life. Turns out he is not actually Kenny Rogers. He is Les Simmons. What's up, Grandpa? Welcome to the podcast. Thanks for doing this.
Well, welcome to Oregon.
You're there. How's things going?
I'm physically here. Mentally, I'm not sure yet.
Where are you mentally?
It takes me a while to figure that one out.
Where are you mentally today?
Where am I what?
Where are you mentally today? Are you in Hawaii?
No, I'm just kind of floating around.
Just floating around?
Just floating around.
There you go. Well, you've been very active pretty much your whole life in making things. You're a maker. You've been a maker forever. When did you get excited about using your hands to actually produce things? And you've done many different kind of making craft projects. What were some of your favorite over the years?
Well, first of all, I can't say that I remember any particular time of getting excited about doing it. Other than my mother was a very crafty person, and she usually involved all of us kids in any of that type of activity. And I can remember, I was about, pardon me, about 10 years old. One of the first things that I remember getting into that kind of thing was we made Christmas gifts for all the family members when I was living up here in Oregon. I was about 10 years old. And we traced cartoons and transferred them onto canvas, white canvas. And then we frayed the edges, sewed them together, and made books out of them and gave them to all of the kids in the family for coloring books. And, some of those kind of things. And then it just one thing led to another. My first time into the leather, I was about 11 years old, I guess, or 12. And I was looking for some way to make extra money. And I happened to stop in Hill's Leathercraft in Bellflower, California, and told him I was looking for work. You got any work? And so he said, yeah. So he started teaching me to do lacing. And I started, because he hated doing lacing. So I started lacing all his wallets and purses and stuff like that. And then he would show me pointers on the carving end of it and such.
That's so, you said you started doing that at 12 years old?
Yeah, about 12.
They didn't have child labor laws back in the 40s, huh?
Well, if they did, nobody paid attention to them.
You were trying to make those bags back then, huh? Making that money.
Well, yeah, I went around vacant lots picking up wine bottles and beer bottles and stuff like that and selling them to the hardware stores because they would take those and fill them with paint thinner and stuff for people.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
So I've always had a hustle of some kind going on. I was about 8 years old. I was shining shoes and selling newspapers. I'd get up at 5 in the morning, sell newspapers, and then I would, as soon as at the shipyards down in the LA Harbor, and when the shifts would be started, I would take up all what papers I had left take off, go home. And then there was an army encampment right close by.
San Pedro, right?
Yeah, that was, well, actually Wilmington. And so then I would go down to the barracks and the squad barracks, and I would shine shoes on for the military for inspection, you know, that kind of stuff.
I guess I get my hustler spirit from you then, huh, Grandpa?
Well, I don't know. I don't know whether that thing can be handed down or not, but, you know, I think a lot of that is your upbringing as far as around the people and friends that you grow up with.
I think that there's certain people that have it, or there's certain people that don't have it, in the drive to be, whether it's entrepreneurs or just hustling, working hard, not being lazy. And some people got it and some people don't.
Well, and those that have it, it usually comes out stronger when they're around people that have somewhat the same mindset.
That's a really good point. And I think that old saying, like, you're the average of your five friends, or you're the average of the people you spend, the five people you spend the most time with, or show me your friends and I'll show you your future, is really, really true. I think about that often.
That has a lot to do with it. Yeah. And, that, and the fact that, it depends a lot on what our individual interests, goals, etc. You know, it's like when I wanted, during the war, when I was doing the papers and shining shoes and stuff, you know, I wanted to build model airplanes and stuff like that. And a lot of the stuff that was available for people to do, like the computers are today and stuff, but my folks couldn't really afford it. I mean, right. My dad was working and my mother was taking care of the family, and we were surviving, you know. So it was a case of, like, for instance, I always wanted a pair of Levi's, not JCPenney's jeans, but Levi's. My mother says, if you want Levi's, then you'll have to go find some way to earn some money to buy them, because we can't afford the $5.95 Levi's when we can buy jeans, regular jeans at JCPenney's for $2.50.
Right, right.
So I started looking around and finding hustles such as shining shoes and things like that. And it got to a point, I was just before we moved to Oregon. And hell, I made almost as one month, I made almost as much money as my dad did. You know, and that impressed me. I thought, if I can do that, I can do anything.
It gets your mindset at a young age of being able to get things done, and sets the tempo for the rest of your life.
Well, and it was something that I was enjoying doing, because I was meeting people, talking to people, etc. And of course, when I would shine a pair of shoes for a quarter, at that time, people had lots of money in their pocket and you couldn't buy anything. Everything was rationed. So I probably, in all my shoe shining career, I probably didn't shine more than a dozen pair of shoes for a quarter. It was always 50 cents or a dollar, you know? And so I saw all this real easy money coming in. So yeah, and then, one thing leads to another. In the same way, as I grew older, I would get into hobbies, and I could see areas in the hobbies to where I can't afford to buy that, but I could probably make it.
You know, that I definitely got that from you then, because that's like, you know, you and I always talk about, and we talk about on the podcast here, like, the importance in how I've kind of tapped into sponsorship and stuff like that. Like, I wouldn't be able to have the tools that are behind me if I didn't get sponsorships, but that's a job in itself, you know, like negotiating and talking. And like, so that's definitely, you know, something that's similar to how it was. And I make a lot of my tools. I think we all do as makers. We're constantly trying to modify the things around us to work just a little bit better.
Well, yeah, it's just like when I was in the 50s, I got interested in skin diving. And so I became a skin diver. Well, I wanted a wetsuit. But hell, a wetsuit at that time was probably about $125, which at that time was a lot of money. And I couldn't really afford it because I had three kids to raise. But I was in the rubber industry making a living, and I made some contacts. So I got a hold of this one fella who we made rubber parts of the swim dry suit for. And so I bought the materials and I built my own wetsuit. I even built a wetsuit for your auntie when she was like about, I guess she was about 7 years old. I built her a wetsuit so that we could go body surfing together.
that's so cool. I've been starting to use neoprene in projects that I'm doing now for straps and stuff that's going to be over the shoulder or whatever I'm using it for. And neoprene isn't easy to work with. It's so it's like overly flexible. It's really hard to stitch through. It stretches. It's hard to glue. And so, man, that's tricky to make a wetsuit.
Well, the thing is, there was a special glue that he had developed where it basically took the neoprene and I think it was toluene and would soak the chopped up pieces in toluene, and toluene would dissolve it and make the glue.
Oh, okay. So then it kind of fused together?
And so they were, yeah, more like fused together. And this was before there was any fabric involved. It was just rubber, and that was it. Where now they have this nylon on the outside and then the neoprene and then nylon on the inside. So, you know, that altogether different materials.
Oh, I see. Yeah, technology has changed in wetsuits, I'm sure. Even since I was younger and I would buy wetsuits to go surf, bodyboard, whatever. Nowadays, the wetsuit technology is a lot better, a lot more flexible too, and just a lot more durable.
Well, that's pretty much true with everything, you know? It's just right. I was into building model airplanes that you flew on wire in a circle. It was called U-Control. And I wanted to get into radio control. Well, radio control at that time, the technology was pretty new and it was very expensive. So I couldn't do it, and I couldn't build it because I didn't have the knowledge to build my electronical components. So, but I look at it, and back then they come out, you know, big deal come out with a transmitter that was proportional so that you got more smoother action instead of all the way up, all the way down type of thing. And then here about 8-9 years ago, I got involved with radio control model airplanes up here in Oregon with my son. And my gosh, I went down to a pawn shop, and for $75, I bought a whole outfit, an airplane, a transmitter, the whole works. And, you know, and it just as smooth as if you were driving a car.
Yeah. The technology has changed so much.
Absolutely. And I could fly them to the point to where I would lose them. Sometimes, of course, my eyes were kind of getting bad, but I kind of lose. Where in the hell did it go to? You know? But, you know, it just, the technology is with so much, I mean. And
what do you think of the modern day drones? You know, have you seen or, you know, researched those much?
I haven't. I had a couple of the small ones that you can fly indoors, and they were fun, but they were real. They were more of a toy than they were a one that you could go out and really do something with. But yeah, I think that the drones have got a lot of potential for a lot of different areas.
Yeah, well, they're using them for a lot of different areas now. You know, it's crazy.
The sad thing is that there's always a handful of people that are going to abuse the privilege of having them and flying them and stuff, because you know sooner or later we're going to read in the news, hear on the news where a commercial airliner has gone down because it hit a drone. Just like the one that went down the Hudson that hit birds.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. You know, it's funny. We're talking about technology and how things change, and that's probably going to be the majority of the tempo throughout this podcast. But I'm curious how the maker community was able to communicate with each other pre the internet age. How were you talking to other jewelers or other RC people or just other people that you were, you know, that were also in whatever craft of your choice at the time? How were you learning and how were you? I mean, I think we're really spoiled now, and people my age and younger are very spoiled in the sense that we grew up with the internet, where we have essentially every encyclopedia, every, you know, manual to every product right at our fingertips. We just have to Google it. How were you able to communicate with like-minded crafters and makers when you were growing up to get information or to share ideas or build friendships and have a community as a whole?
One-on-one.
One-on-one, huh?
Yeah. If you needed, like if I needed to know something about the leather, then I looked around to find people that were doing it. And then I would telephone them on the old dial 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 around in circles.
The rototiller?
And it's the same way with the radio control. If I wanted to learn something about the radio control, I found other like-minded people that were doing it. And what I did was I joined a club called the Rogue Valley. Oh yeah, Eagles, Rogue Valley Eagles. And of course, some of these guys have been doing it radio control from the beginning. So they've had grown up with all the different technologies. So, you know, they'd say, well, you know, you got to get this kind of servo and that kind of servo, and you got to have, you know, this kind of, and then the batteries, the flight batteries, instead of having a whole bunch of dry cells in them, you had ions or, you know, some of the more modern batteries and such. So, yeah, you just had to go one-on-one or pick up books and read.
I think that it's so much different. And like I said, I wanted to preference it by saying that, you know, people in my generation of makers are very spoiled, and not in a bad sense. Like we just can't take it for granted. But yesterday I was talking to somebody that was from Siberia, and the person before that was from Canada. Like we're privy to be able to you know, have really good, meaningful conversations with anybody all over the world at this point. And we're so fortunate. And I think that that's what I really want to kind of drive home, is how things have changed from where if you grew up in a small town and there wasn't a leather shop, then you had to drive to the shop or, you know, drive somewhere else and go find a Tandy store. Like you said, the one that was in your town in LA, whatever it was, and get as much information, buy the books, get all of the stuff, where now there's videos basically to show us everything. And it's spectacular. I'm just curious, like, yeah, it's just interesting to me how you were able to get so much information, because you're a master craftsman at so many different things. It almost seems like you wrote the book in a lot of instances.
Well, I don't know about that, but the thing is, I think one of the real advantages is not only can you Google up the information, or you can talk to, as you pointed out, these two people from, you know, from out of the country, but you can also sit there and talk to them and see it, and they can visually show you what your, you know, the answer to your question. And that, you know, that is so much. I know when I was in high school and school period, I could read a subject matter over and over and over and over again, and maybe I would get it if I read it enough times. But if I had someone show me what that same information was saying, they only had to do it once and I had it.
We're the same person. I am your grandson. That's exactly how it is for me. I get like, I think about where I'm at now in my late 30s and think like, man, I made it through high school and most of college, but if I could go back and take courses now that were more focused on the way that I learn, which is visually and hands-on and actively learning, I would ace every single course possible. Like, I just know I would.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because that's one of the things that in one respect, I think that the younger people have an opportunity that they don't really understand or see, is the opportunity to have that one-on-one, hands-on type education.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it's just, you know, you show me how to do it, I'll do it. But tell me how to do it, I got to try to figure out what you're talking about and what you mean by different phrases you might use in order to get the point across.
I think a lot of it too, I mean, we talked the last time you were on the Monday Motivation podcast, and we were talking about how, you know, you built a house up in Alaska, and a lot of that was being self-taught. I think that we have an advantage in 2022 where we can be self-taught. We don't have to have a formal education in leathercraft or in woodworking. Like, we can learn a lot online, but a lot of it comes from trial and error. The thing that I think is different when you were younger is you had to do it trial and error with way less information.
Well, and not only that, but, you know, one of the main things is that you have to know how to use the tools of whatever it is you're going to be involved with. And using the tools is the big key. And you can't teach how to handle tools by writing it down on paper.
No, that's impossible.
You know, you have to show them, now, this is the way you hold it, this is the way you use it, this is the way you take care of it, etc. And if you can't do that, and you can't learn how to handle tools, I don't care how much information you get, it's not going to work like it should.
Right, right. You know, it's funny that you say that, because you've done so many different hands-on crafting, handmade stuff, from building a house in Alaska with your hands, being a jeweler for as many years as you were, doing leathercraft, doing antler work, all of these different things that require so many tools. How much of your ability do you think comes from the you know, a lot of those crafts are going to have similar functions as far as the tools that are used within them, and some don't. Did you find that your basic understanding of tools obviously helped you transferring from one craft to another to another?
Oh yeah, without a doubt, because you take a tool and it's designed for leather, and you look at it and you try to, you know, you want to use the tool, you want to do something else, you want to do something on some other kind of material, and yet all you got is this leather tool. Well, you know how it works on leather, but I wonder if it'll work like this on this product. If not, maybe I can do it like this and it'll work.
Yeah.
And so you kind of trial and error, you kind of figure out, and sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't, you know. Yeah. Some tools just, they are designed for that particular product, and that's it. Yeah. Like a skill saw, you can't use a skill saw on leather.
No, that wouldn't be a good thing at all, unless it was glued down. Like, even then, that just doesn't seem like...
It wouldn't work well. It wouldn't work well.
We're definitely not advising you to use a skill saw to cut your leather. That'd be a bad idea. That would be a very bad idea. So you've done a lot of different things. What were some of your favorite adventures into making? Like I mentioned before, you did jewelry stuff. You've done antler stuff. You've had a lot of awesome stories. Where did you find the most joy?
Oh, it's kind of hard to say. Because each one of them, there was a great bit. I think the one thing that they all had in common was the satisfaction of taking, well, for the lack of a better word, an inanimate object and transforming it into something useful or creative.
Yeah, that seems to be the foundation for all makers, is taking something that is inanimate and making it into something that you can use, whether that's making a wallet with leather, whether that's making a piece of jewelry with turquoise and silver or gold or whatever it is, where on itself it's just a rock essentially. It's when you melt it down and you're able to make something artistic out of it, it's the end product that is...
Yeah, that's where the satisfaction is. And sometimes the product, when you're finished with it, you think, oh my God, is that ugly or what?
Melt it down.
And I think, oh well, hell, that goes in the melt pot. And somebody would come along and say, oh my God, I've been looking for something like that all my life. Well, there it is.
It's so funny. You and I, you know, we talk multiple times a week. We spend a lot of time talking, and that's something that I always say. It's the things that I make for myself, or it's the things that I'm not necessarily all that thrilled with, or I make it, and you know, I put it out there on social media or whatever, and those are the pieces that people are just excited about. It's the ones that I spend a whole bunch of time, and in my head the whole time I'm thinking like, man, people are going to think this is so badass, and then it isn't. It's funny how that works out.
Well, of course, myself, I guess one of the things that I have with all the different crafts and stuff that I've done is I like to experiment. That bang, 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 same thing, same thing, same thing. You know, that gets real boring in a hurry. And I like to try it. It's just like with jewelry. You know, I would start it off with the Navajo style jewelry. And that was fun. But pretty soon it started getting like, well, you know, it's getting kind of boring or getting a little bit, you know, hard to create something different. So then I said, well, I'll try some Hopi style. And I tried that, and that was, that's great. This is neat. And then I tried the Zuni, you know, and I kept trying the different styles, and all of them were fun, and all of them were creative. And the same way with the airplanes, you know, I liked the radio control airplanes. That's cool. Certain kinds of airplanes flew better than others, but then it was getting boring. So then I started trying to do the vertical takeoff airplanes, and I started building boats, you know, with the same technology.
You're always pushing yourself to the next thing. And
well, I don't know whether pushing is the right word, but if I'm going to do something, same way with my leather, I like, and I find items that I enjoy doing that way. And the things that I enjoy doing, it's like, I don't really enjoy building wallets. I really don't enjoy building wallets. So I don't make very many of them. But now these valet trays and coasters and things like that, they're fun because I can be a little bit creative here and there and make them different.
Right. Artistic. Yeah, I think that's fantastic. And I see the stuff that you make, obviously. I own a bunch of the stuff that you make. And I think that it's really cool. And it's, you know, you've been a huge inspiration to me through Leathercraft. I mean, Leathercraft in itself brought us together in a way that I never expected. You know, my mom told you that I had started Leathercraft, and it spawned we didn't talk to each other for a number of years. Nothing bad. It's just, we just didn't. And now,
well, geographically, we were separated quite a ways for quite a while.
Right. But whenever I discuss this, I always, you know, I preference it, or I make it known that it wasn't anything negative that we didn't talk. I was a kid, and kids don't want to call their grandparents all the time. Then I became a teenager. Then I became a young adult, and just time and space kept us not talking. Again, it wasn't that anything bad happened. It's just, it is what it is. But when I had gotten into Leathercraft, you've always been somebody that I could reach out to for questions and kind of learn from a lot of your experiences, both positive and negatively. And people ask me all the time, you know, like, what got you into the tattoo side of imagery for my projects? And I always reference you in the sense that, you know, you were pressing me to try out the leather stamping and tooling and stuff like that. And I put up such a huge resistance because I don't have any interest in like the Western tack stuff. And I thought that that's all you could do. And you made it very clear. You're like, no, take some of the images that you did in tattooing, and you know, you really pressed me on it. You're like, just do one for me. And now that's what my entire career is based around. And I just wanted to thank you.
Well, I am glad that I was able to help give you some kind of inspiration to do something with it, because you are a very artistically talented person. And that talent can be put into so many different things that, you know, it doesn't have to be just, you know, paint on canvas or anything like that. I mean, you can use it a lot of different ways.
Well, I thank you. I thank you for the kind words and believing in me, because I wouldn't have even thought that. I don't think that I'd be where I'm at if you didn't see in me what I couldn't see in myself. And that's one of hundreds and hundreds of different situations. We've had conversations, and I want to kind of elaborate on that further into the podcast. But we're going to take a quick ad break, and when we come back, we're going to discuss more about that, as well as what my grandpa thinks has changed since he started to where it is as far as the maker community, tools, all of that kind of stuff. We have quite a bit more to talk to Les Simmons about, and we're going to take a quick ad break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the podcast, guys. We have Les Simmons, aka my grandpa. He's joining us for today's podcast, which is super awesome. We were talking before about his experience within the maker arena his whole life. How old are you, Grandpa, if you don't mind me asking?
86.
86 years old. And you got into making, you said, at what? When did you start making those coloring books?
Oh, God, I was about eight, nine years old.
Dang, so you've got over 70 years involved in...
Crafts of some kind,
yeah, that's...
I've done that copper tooling. I did, and then when I was in school, from all the way through school, I always took one or two craft classes. I even took a leather class in school when I was living in Bellflower, but that didn't last long because our teacher was a fellow from England. And the guy that I was working with at Hill Leathercraft gave me a box of scraps to give to the kids at school to make key fobs and stuff like that with. And the teacher started charging the kids for it. And I told Hill about it. And he went to school and jumped right in the middle of his you-know-what. And they let him go. They got rid of the teacher. So I wasn't very popular after that.
Well, yeah, because snitches get stitches. You know better, Grandpa. Come on. You know the street code.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
That was one of my first lessons on it.
Yeah. Yeah, I bet. That's insane. Your schools growing up offered a lot more classes in the sense of crafting and art and stuff like that than they do now, right?
Well, the same way, you know, we used to have auto shop, woodworking, electrical, you know, all of that. And now some of the schools in our area anyway are starting to reincorporate those into our schools so that these kids are better prepared to go out and work with their hands. That's a whole other subject, you know, that they're too much political influence in our education system.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I'm not even an old guy, and I feel that, well, maybe I'm getting older, but I totally feel that way. And it's crazy, but it kind of leads into the next thing I wanted to talk to you about, which is, what do you think has changed in the maker community from when you were really, really active with jewelry and, you know, in Oregon and all of that kind of stuff? What do you think has changed for your generation compared to my generation? We talk about my activity within the leather community and the maker community as a whole. How do you see when you were my age or even younger, the things that have changed to the stories that we talk about now together?
Well, you know, there's really, I haven't seen the changes. I guess I would characterize it as have more or are more influenced by the economy fluctuations than they used to be. Because first of all, part of that is because we are more aware. The news media tells us on a daily basis whether the country's going broke or making money and stuff like that. So we're more aware of what influence the world economy has on everything, down to the food that you buy in the grocery store.
It's so interesting to think about that, and it's so true. I've never, ever thought about that. Like, before, you wouldn't know that the economy was bad until it affected you or your family directly. Now, you might not even be directly affected by the economy, but you hear about it, and it causes fear in general.
Yeah, it can. You know, you're going along great with your particular business, and it's making plenty of money, and you want to grow it. You want to improve it. You have an area you want to, with the economy, you know, you're all set to spend $50,000 on your business. But you've been listening to the TV or whatever, and it's saying, boy, we're headed into a big, deep recession.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to be in deep doo-doo.
Yeah.
And so on and so forth. You're going to say, well, hey, you know, I better hold on to that. I better not do that. Wait and see what happens. So you don't grow.
Yeah. Well, not only that, but the consumer then gets scared about it and they hold on to their money. And then the people that are selling don't get it. And then the economy doesn't get stimulated because people aren't spending money because they're scared and they hold on to it.
Yeah. And then our government sets in and they throw money at it. They're going to solve the problem. They're going to give us stimulus money. Well, you know, sooner or later, we got to pay it back.
Right. Then our money doesn't even matter anymore because of inflation.
So that would be, I think, probably one of the biggest things is that it's the news media needs to wipe their nose and wipe their butt and keep the hell out of the, you know, I mean, they give us way, way, way too much information.
I think if you want to seek out that information on your own, that's great, but...
Yeah, yeah. Make it available, but you don't have to blow it out the window.
Well, the thing is that news in general is a for-profit business, and their business is to sell fear. Like the saying goes, if it bleeds, it leads. People, I don't know what it is about human psychology that people can't look away from a train wreck. So people get very intrigued by the negative stories and fear mongering that they can't turn away from it. And they turn in like it's a soap opera, but this is our real life. And they invest their whole life. And I'm guilty of it myself at times. Like I'm very fascinated by like geopolitics and politics in general. Like, but this is real life. And they sell us fear and we're buying it.
Well, first of all, you know, we are a part of the animal kingdom. Okay. And, our ancestry goes back to where, you know, pardon the expression, blood and guts was a fact of life. So consequently, there is that that certain amount of fascination that maybe it's ingrained in our DNA. I don't know. That when, because you go down the street and how many people do you see slowing down at a wreck to see if there's any blood and guts?
We're all guilty of it. I'm guilty. We can both talk so much shit about it, but when it boils down to it, we're just as guilty as anybody else.
Like, absolutely. It's a part of the human nature. So, and when it comes to news broadcasting, if somebody says something about blood and guts on the news, everybody right away looks, oh boy, what's going on? But you never hear, or very, very little, about the greatness of some of these people or the humane side of people. You don't hear much about it. No, it's because who's interested in John Doe giving Jane Doe a help across the carrier across the muddy street? You know, who cares?
Yeah, it's wild. When do you think in your whole history of making, when do you think was the best time? Like what decade to you? Excuse me. What decade to you was the most even if it was just financially profitable where you were, was it when you were doing the jewelry in the, that was during the 80s, 90s?
When I was working out of my house,
yeah,
making turquoise jewelry when turquoise was the big thing in the 70s and the 80s.
I love like, I want to get a turquoise ring now. Tell us more about that time period, the 70s and 80s with...
More people were, they had money to spend, and they were more into self-gratification, I think. Our economy was in pretty good shape, and the news media wasn't as active because there wasn't any blood and guts to sell.
Well, what we didn't have the 24-hour news channels either like we do now. The invention of the 24-hour news channels is a huge detriment to all of us.
Oh, I agree. But here's the thing. We don't have to watch it, but we do.
Yeah, I'm guilty of it, man.
I do. I have to watch news every day. And I think that watching the newscasts for information is good. To know, I like to know what's going on over there in, Russia. You at least be aware. You don't have to have all the graphic stuff of people laying dead in the street and stuff like that, but at least have a knowledge of what's going on.
The news, not the opinion, just the news and the sense of what is happening.
So that you can plan your life, that you can, it's good.
With that said, I mean, you went into pretty good detail about how things have kind of changed from when you started to now, as far as the ups and downs with the economy and how people treat it. What are your hopes for this generation of makers? Like, what's the positive that you see that's different now than it was when you were growing up? Whether that's information, the technical abilities, the progression of different crafts. What gives you hope? Seeing me, your grandson, or other people that you admire within leathercraft or woodworking or whatever it is.
Well, I think that part of it, one of the biggest parts of it, is the economy. One, of course, you have to have a reasonably sound, active economy for people to spend for frivolous things, and leather goods. It's really a frivolous thing.
It's a luxury item.
Yeah, it's not something we have to have. But I do think that with the technology that we have available, if the craft people can work together at it, they can take advantage of the technology to help grow the craft and keep the craft out in the front light so that people are aware of it. Because for many, many, many years, and leather working has been around since men wore skins, okay?
Since the beginning.
And so consequently, it's not something new, but it's like the Western style leatherwork was around for so long that it became very boring. If you weren't a cowboy or a cowgirl, what the hell are you doing running around with all this leather with roses and shit all over it? But and I think that that's the one edge that you've got, in as much as you have taken an age-old craft and you've brought it into the modern day reality of what can be done with it.
That's what my goal is, for sure, is to modernize it, because I'm no cowboy.
And if you use the technology to help promote that, to help people become aware of the fact that it doesn't have to have roses and leaves on it to be leather crafts, that it can be a lot of other things and still be leather craft.
Absolutely. Skulls and daggers and scorpions and all the stuff I think is cool. And you know, what's funny is that that's totally what I intend to do. We have discussions all the time, and I tell you about how much I really love doing the educational side of stuff and sharing the knowledge and how to kind of convert the traditional tattoo style into leather. And, you know, we've had some really, really deep, long conversations about, you know, you're always weary and you're always concerned that I'm going to share too much information and someone's going to steal my market because of it. And to me, I want more people to get into the traditional tattoo style, even the portrait style stuff. And it's not that I'm in fear of doing it. It's because I want to be a forerunner for it and an advocate for it and a person that will have a legacy within it, that I was one of the first people to do it. And I'm very transparent. You know this, Grandpa. The people that are listening knowing, like, I want to be the maker that's like the Rachel Ray. And I say Rachel Ray in the sense that, like, I want to license my name, 21 grams, to companies to make tools with and to make paintbrushes with and different things that are 21 grams. And because, to be honest with you, and you probably would agree with me, or maybe you won't, but just making wallets is not going to be able to sustain a financial lifestyle that I want. Like, I want to be a millionaire, and making wallets, no matter how much I charge for them, there just isn't enough time in the day to become a millionaire making wallets and belts and sandals and little trinkets. Like, I need to do much bigger things.
Oh yeah. Well, that I agree. For it to really get up to that point to where people would be willing to buy anything that has 21 grams on it, you have to make people aware that there's many, many things you can do with those tools besides make a wallet. And that's the reason why sometimes I say, the latest one that we mentioned when you did your sandals. Well, your sandals, that's one step, pardon the pun, in the right direction. But there's also satellites to those sandals, such as visors, such as who knows what else, little day bags, backpacks and the little day bags. And so, there's a lot of things where you can incorporate some of the same stuff that you do on the wallet.
That reminds me, because there's always been, your advice for me always has been to make things at different price points and have different tiers of products for different people. Like everything, because I am who I am and you are who you are, I always push back against that at first, and then I do it and I'm like, oh, that's great. Now I preach it from this podcast to have things at different price points. If that's a key fob for people that can, so people can buy something from you at $10, $15, $20, something that's at a low price range, something that's at a middle price range, and something that's at a high value price range. And now I'm so about it, but I'm a stubborn dude, you know that. And can you talk a little bit more about your experience with that, having things at those different tier lists?
Well, it's just like with when I was doing the jewelry. I had turquoise rings anywhere from $15 to $500. That pretty much says it all right there, because there's a lot more people can afford a $15 turquoise ring and can $500. So how many $15 rings does it take to make $500?
I could do it if I had a count. There's 50, yeah, like 35, 40? No. Yeah, something like that. I'll probably be wrong, and somebody will write in the comments how I don't know anything about math, whatever.
But the thing about it is, it's a lot of them. So it's like I said before, you get these people, there's, you know, you're going to get, we'll say you're going to get 500 people into your store in a month. And if all 500 of those people bought a $15 ring, if only one person walked in and bought a $500 ring, you'd be about the same place. But what are the odds?
Yeah. And I think in this day and age too, is that everyone that's a maker and putting their stuff out online or even at markets, you're almost an influencer to a certain degree. And that might sound foreign to you and you may not understand what I'm saying. The majority of the audience will, but people want to support. If I came to a market, Grandpa, and you had a booth there and we got to talking and, you know, we kicked it off, by the time I leave, I want to spend some kind of money with you. I may not be able to buy the $500 ring and I might not have the cash for it, but I have 15 bucks in my pocket. Whether I want the $15 ring or not, I want something from you because you made it. And that's what I think is important too, that we need to discuss collectively as a community.
And there is so many things out there that, you know, like as a, for instance, the key fobs, okay? The key fobs you can make out of leather. You can make them in many, many, many different shapes and configurations. And a lot of people, but, well, you know, they got, it'll help keep me from losing my keys. Okay. Then you got people that, hell, they don't give a shit about whether they lose their keys or not, but they sit around and do a lot of reading. So a nice, there's several different styles of bookmarks. Very basic, very simple to make, another $5 or $10 item. Okay, and you can keep working it at different levels like that. Then you can get into, like, some people that, you know, would like to have a nice book cover, or, you know, just on and on. And the variety of your products available are going to automatically cover that spectrum of 10 to 500.
And not only that, but if somebody buys something at that low tier price point, it's a gateway for them to come back to you. It opens up a relationship and they're like, oh, remember that guy that we got that bookmark from, whatever, you know, I need to get this Bible covered, or I need, you know, I really like to get a belt, right? You know, Grandpa's birthday's coming up. Let's get him a new wallet made, something really fancy, something really nice. And I think it took me a long time to come to grips with that because of my ego. Like, I wanted to jump on the scene and make things at a really high price point and be kind of like the Kanye West, if you will. Like, nothing's going on sale, everything's expensive. Like, I put my heart, blood, you know, my blood, sweat and tears into each one of these things. Like, I want people to admire my work as much as I do. Then you realize you're broke and you're only making things for yourself or whatever. You got to be able to support your habit by selling things at a certain price point.
And another advantage of some of these items that I mentioned, you're going to have a lot of leather pieces that are scrap that one will not make a wallet, or even parts of a wallet, but they'll make key fobs, or they'll make bookmarks, or they'll make this, or they'll make that.
That's what I do now. All of my scrap now, I keep in a bucket underneath my workbench. And there's, you know, there's pieces that, like you said, you can't use for even a pocket insert for a wallet, but I can snap out one or two, you know, key fobs that I have dies for on my press behind. And every few months I'll come out here and make a whole day of it where I'm not filming any videos. I'm not doing anything. Maybe I'll watch, you know, some Netflix or listen to some good music and take myself off the internet and just do monotonous things I don't got to think about. But that's what helps me with my burnout, as well as doing something I don't have to think about. And then I have a whole supply of key fobs, and I put out like something that I don't think is unique to me, but it is something that I do every time that I send out a paid product, something that people pay for. I always add a key fob, because It's low cost advertisement. If people have your key fob on their keys all the time, what more do you, I mean, you, people see others' keys more than they see their wallets.
And some of these products can be introduced into medium, like, okay, you bookmarks. Well, you contact a couple of bookstores and they, you know, you make a little deal where you have a whole bunch of different ones, symbols of the zodiac or whatever, and you got these laying there and they're $3, $5 a piece, whatever they are, but they're sitting there near the cash register. And they come, they buy a book and they're, hey, that's a good idea.
I spent $17 on this book. I'll spend the other $3 and it's an even 20. Like those kinds of things, so valuable. And it might not even be that you make your $1 million off of those little things, but what it does is it gets your products out to more people's eyes. If you're selling a product at $500 and it doesn't get out to anyone, but you're selling, like you said, the $15 ring and you're selling 500 of them, there's going to be someone at a dinner party, there's going to be someone at a barbecue, some kind of gathering that's going to be like, hey, where'd you get that ring? And they're like, oh, Les, you know, downtown, this jewelry, you know, this jeweler made it for me. And then they send someone down to you, Grandpa, and buy the $500 ring.
A point that you made was talking about when I was making the Indian style jewelry, everybody in the valley here called me Lester Mini Rings because I used to wear three or four rings on each hand. Because, and then I go out to one of the pubs and start sucking down a beer or two, and all the cute little waitresses that run around, oh, gee, you're wearing here. Oh, gee, that's pretty turquoise. Where did you get that? Will I make it? Oh, really? Could you make me one? Well, I suppose we could work something out.
That's funny. Yeah, whatever you got to do. That, I mean, it's the same thing. That was the same thing when I was tattooing too, being heavily tattooed and having business cards. And this was back when I would party a lot, going out to the bars. You always want to go out to the bars closest to your tattoo shop and in communities like that. And you go out and you have a couple drinks and you start getting talkative with both men and women, and all of a sudden your appointment's booked completely full for the entire week just by going out and chatting.
There you go.
Yeah, and we do that now in our weird dystopian world that we live on the internet. Like you can still do that now, just I think it's different. People don't go outside as much.
Well, it's just like when you go onto the internet to do something. If you have your shirt on,
or my hat,
or your hat, because the one thing about the name, and I think it's great, but it doesn't say leather.
No, it doesn't on the advertisement like that, but it does. I mean, all of my social media and website, it's
your promotional stuff will say leather.
It's searchable online, but I get what. The reason why I don't do that is because I want people to actually wear my stuff. And I feel that if I wouldn't wear something that was, that said 21 grams leather goods or.
Oh no, I don't mean to change that. What I'm saying is that if you have a lot of leather products, you know, that you're displaying at the time that they're talking and they say, 21 grams. What's that about? Well, that's the name of my business. 21 grams leather goods. Oh, leather goods. You mean like the stuff you're wearing?
I got a question for you, Grandpa. So the shirt that you're wearing, for the people that are just listening to this, it's one of my shirts because my grandpa's my biggest supporter. And on the back, it has, in quotes, somewhere between Jay-Z and Johnny Cash. And, do you get, that's so awesome. Do you get asked anytime when you're out in public, like what that means or about, I know you know who Johnny Cash is, but I don't know if you're getting down with Hova. You know what I mean?
Well, I'm not sure what your meaning was behind it, but for as far as the jazz goes, when I was probably 13 to 15, 16 years old, I used to go down to Hermosa Beach to one of the big jazz centers down there. And two or three of us guys would go down there, and we'd sit out on the curb and listen to the jazz music because we couldn't go into the, well, we couldn't go in. We were too young. But you could hear the music outside, so we'd go down and sit on the curb and listen to the jazz. Once in a while, we got run off by the cops, but yeah. But I've always had a taste for jazz music.
Were you a big fan of, have you been a big fan of like eclectic music? Do you listen to a lot of different genres of music, or has it always been jazz?
I listen to, I've always been pretty well rounded in the way of music. I like country western, some of it. I even like some of the light opera music, but my ears have gotten so bad with age that I don't even listen to the radio anymore.
You know what? Having this conversation with you right now is probably one, since I went and visited you, has been one of the easiest conversations because, one, I don't have to hold a phone up to my ear, which, I absolutely hate. I hate holding a phone to my ear, and I can never sit down long enough to do that anyways. The fact that you have actual earphones on, it, more so the fact that you can hear me makes things so much more pleasant to talk to you. It's nice. This is great. And I'm also not in a rush with the whole, like, all right, Grandpa, I'll call you back. I got to go. Because I'm still a child. I'm always going to still be a child.
Well, and the one thing that, too, is I guess with me getting to the point of my life that I am, I know that I'm near the end of the rope.
Which is sad and breaks my heart.
Getting near the end of the rope. And so each time that I talk to someone that's special or whatever, it's very important to me. And I guess the thing that that we've been able to get through to each other is the thing of, if you say, I'm going to call you tomorrow, you call tomorrow. If not, don't say it. I'll call you when I can, a type of thing.
Let your yeses be yeses and your noes be noes. If you're going to do something, stick to it.
And there's always something that can come up that can change things. But there's always the opportunity to say, hey, something come up, I won't be able to make it.
Not to talk on the harder side of conversations, but you mentioned, you're getting towards the end of your life here, whatever. And I think that that's what made this so important to me to get you onto the podcast. This is a lot of knowledge and hopefully a good experience for the people that are listening, but this is more in a completely selfish way, something for me to be able to document this chapter of my life, because of the last 2 years, me getting into leather work and all of that kind of stuff, more than that, I'll throw that away in a second, but it's what the relationship that I was able to kind of rekindle with you, which has been so important to me, and for me to be able to document this so that when I have kids, they'll know who their great grandpa was, and they'll know where their artistic side and their hard work and their integrity comes from. And it's really important to me to document this, and that's why it was important for me to have you on.
Well, the one thing that I'll say is I hope that I can hang around long enough to see my great-great-grandchild.
Is it great-great? No, it's just no, because yeah. No. You're my grandpa.
You are, it's a great-grandchild.
Yeah.
Just great.
Yeah, just
one.
A great.
No, grandpa, then great-grandpa. Right.
And that'll be that, I hope so too. We're trying as hard as we can, we're as much as we can at our age. It's not easy. With that said, you've been doing this a long time, And it kind of transfers into what the direction we're going next. And you've instilled a lot of knowledge into me, not even the fundamentals or the mechanics of leather work, but how to manage my time, how to manage my money, how those kinds of things within building a business, a successful business at this point. And what is some of the advice that you would give to makers younger than you, my generation, based off of the mistakes that you've made in your past? What would you like to help prevent other people from doing that you did, and you learned by doing the mistakes?
Oh, I don't know. There's so many of them. I've made so many mistakes in my life. I think the one thing that I would want them to take away from this is that if you have the true desire to create, regardless of what area, whether it's a pen and pencil or a hammer and chisel or whatever, if you really have a desire to create, then step forward and give it a try. And don't be afraid of making a mistake, because with a mistake comes learning. If you don't make any mistakes, you're not going to learn anything.
All of the people that are great in their field are the people that made the most mistakes, because we all have to make mistakes to get to that point. Every aspect, every single day, you have to do that. Another thing that all take into that you've really, really pressed into me, and it's been beneficial, not just for my business, but for my relationships, and specifically my relationship with my fiance, that I'll take for the rest of my life, is never be too busy for your partner.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Because when all is said and done, no matter how much money you make, no matter how much or how great your creations are, when it comes right down to the wire, all you got left is family.
100%. You've instilled that in me. You even stopped me. If you know when I'm overworking myself, which is 90% of my all the time, I'm always overworking myself. But you'll call me out and tell me, hey, take it easy. Go have lunch with Michelle. Or you're always so concerned about that aspect, even more so than what it is that I have on my workbench. You're always more concerned about the relationship more than anything else. And so that's something I want you to know, Grandpa, that's something that when you're long gone in heaven or wherever destination, the next plane of life, that's something that will still be not only incredibly important in my life, but the next generation of your great grandkids, something that I'll instill. That sure, work ethic is important, but there needs to be a balance with relationship as well.
Well, the thing is with the work, the work ethic is necessary, because if you don't work, you don't make money. If you don't make money, you don't eat. If you don't eat, you're done. You know, it's pretty simple. So this is something.
You're not suggesting people be lazy by any means. I know that.
Oh, no. You don't have to go 900 miles an hour, but you can't just set a stop sign and wait. You have to keep moving. So if you do that, the rest of it will come in, as long as you temper everything, you know?
Yeah, 100%.
It's just like a good glass of wine is good once in a while.
Yeah.
But you don't have to drink it all the time.
That boils down to my whole, I mean, that's such a good analogy, because I do everything at 900 miles an hour, whether it was before when I was drinking and using drugs to now it's work. And that could be just as dangerous as abusing anything.
Absolutely.
And having a voice of reason and having, I don't know, I have this, you know, and this part of the conversation it's hard to talk about, but like I have this unhealthy need and want to let people know that I'm really working, that I have good work ethic, that if I say I'm going to show up, all of these things, that It overwhelms me at times, and I put that before anything else. Like, the worst thing that someone could call me is lazy. Like, you could call me a motherfucker, an asshole, all of those things, but you call me lazy, we're gonna fight.
You know, want to know something? One of your biggest problems is that you are trying to prove to people.
You're right.
And what you need to do is just, you know, yesterday's gone. It's behind you. Behind you. Forget about yesterday. Take care of today and make today the best day that you got. It's the only one you're going to have. It's today.
If you got a foot on yesterday and a foot on tomorrow, you're pissing on today, right?
You can't change yesterday because it's gone. You can't do a thing about tomorrow because it's not here yet. The only thing you got control of is today, right now.
That's so true, Grandpa. I'm getting better at that. I'm learning to take time to spend, to contribute.
And you don't have to prove a bunch of shit to a whole bunch of people. All you got to do is prove life to yourself. Prove it to yourself, and you've done it. You've done it time and time and time again, and you continue to do it through your art.
Yeah, and that's I think that at times that's the scariest part, because I've been on top of the world through my career as an artist. I've been completely, still wasn't satisfied. And it's hard to find satisfaction, or, you know, it's hard to be satisfied at times at any level of your career. And it can be really bad, and it can be a really hard place to be in your head at times, you know?
But your art is your job. Your art is your living. And like I say, all you got to do is provide, you know, the sustenance for you and the ones around you that depend on you. And everything else is about life and having a good time, and with your family, and showing your family a good time. And, you know, you can't, you know, take a sip of that wine. Just don't guzzle the whole bottle.
Well, I'm done with my drinking years. I know my lesson with that. But
no, I'm using that. Oh, as an analogy. I
know. And you know what? You know, something I've been spending a little bit of time thinking about, and I mentioned quite a bit, is for me, or for people in general, you work to be able to afford things that you find enjoyment in. I do what I enjoy. So the money that I make in this is for utilities, for the food, the roof over the head, the all of the things that make things. Because if I had another job that I was paying for all of those other utilities with, this is what I'd be doing to find my joy in life. This is the happiness. So I don't need, I mean, like I keep saying, like I don't need to make the millions of dollars. I just want to, because it's a goal of mine. Really, it's not about the money. It's more about the challenge than anything else.
You know, a friend of mine that I worked for, very, very smart, very well-to-do man, he says, when you're working and you're creating, don't think about money. It'll follow. It'll follow.
Grandpa, we're gonna wrap things up here for the podcast, but I wanted to ask you, and to leave like on a really positive note, and there's no time restraint, but I would like to hear some of your proudest moments, not necessarily just as a maker, but just some of the things that you've done in life, the experiences, the stories that you have about when you felt the right kind of proud, not the ego proud, but like when you were happy, if it was building the house in Alaska or the, you know, having the jewelry shop, when were you the proudest of yourself?
Well, some of my proudest moments was when I walked into the hospital and saw my kids. It was a pretty proud time to think that that little life laying there is part of me. And I've had other proud moments too. You know, and building the house in Alaska was one of them. Yeah. And then I have a lot of little proud moments that I sit and chew on a lot.
Grandpa, I love you.
I love you too.
I'm so grateful that you took the time to do this with me. This is something that will be cherished for years and years and years to come. This means the world to me, and I'm grateful not just to Leathercraft and the community, but the opportunity that it rebuilt our relationship. And really, I wouldn't even say rebuilt it. It gave birth to our relationship, and the conversations that we have all of the time, and the trip to go see you, and the advice that you've given to not just me, but to Michelle, and, you know, all of the time that you've spent to instill in me good values. I want to, from the bottom of my heart, really thank you, Grandpa.
Well, that's what families do, and that's what grandpas do.
I love you so much.
I love you.
All right. Well, guys, thank you for tuning in. I hope you guys aren't, crying your eyes out like I feel like I am right now. But thank you guys so much. If you made it this far in the podcast, I just ask that you'll subscribe, like, share it with, a friend or 17. Get the word out, because I love doing this. This is very special to me. And until next week, we'll see you guys later.
Bye-bye.
All right, see ya.
I've seen a lot of change, been through a lot of pain. Some things are not the same as they were a year ago. But all will be okay, I move on each and every day. The past is where it stays, way back a year ago.